This is the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 6th, 2016. Current federal tax developments are brought to you, as always, by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols Patrick CP Incorporated. I'm Ed Zollers, and I'll be presenting you with this week's developments in the area of federal taxes. We've had a few of them this week come up. We're going to talk about some of them here. First thing is, we're going to have a little issue that you might have read about earlier this week, where the IRS is going to start notifying victims of tax-related identity theft, let's say employment-related identity theft, of the fact that their Social Security number was used on W-2s for another person's return. Previously, if the IRS caught that and had set it aside and didn't send any notices, they hadn't been doing that. We're going to start doing that. We got that coming up this week. We're going to talk about the issue where a taxpayer discovered the bad news about what qualifies for the American Opportunity Tax Credit. We also have some additional guidance given this week for taxpayers who ended up preparing returns before Congress decided to fix laws that expired last year, this on bonus depreciation and the special 179 rules related to real property. We'll talk about that as to how that one works at this point and some of the catch up we have there. We're going to talk about the Ninth Circuit's ruling in the Shea Holmes case, interesting issue there where the IRS decided maybe they argued the wrong point at the tax court. And we get a discussion of that in the case. We have the IRS taking a look at the same rules should apply for Coverdell IRAs for Coverdell ESAs. Remember that we changed that. It used to be education IRAs. Now they're Coverdell ESAs as applied to traditional IRAs. And we ended up getting final regulations for the definition of marriage to follow up on the Obergefell and the Windsor cases from the Supreme Court. Well, it's getting to that time of year. We're in the fall. The summer now has ended, right, because we're here at just past Labor Day because we're releasing this officially. The release date of this is Tuesday, and most of you probably will hear it on the day after Labor Day. And because of that, we're in CPE season. We've got a few things coming up I wanted to mention for you here in the month of September before we get to the end of this month. Don Cochran will be presenting a business industry tax update in Nevada. On the 22nd, he'll be presenting in Reno, and on the 23rd in Las Vegas, so we'll have the business and industry-related tax developments that have taken place this year. I'm also going to be presenting four different sessions for the North Dakota Society of CPAs at their annual convention in Bismarck. That runs from September 25th to September 27th at the Ramcota Hotel in Bismarck. I'll be talking about in various breakout sessions on small business retirement plan options, the self-employment tax and FICA issues for S corporations and pass-throughs. We'll give you an individual income tax update and a discussion about identity theft and tax practice. Following that, I'll have a couple of days in Boise, Idaho for the Idaho Society of CPAs. I'll be giving a session on fringe benefits on September the 29th, and I'll be talking about partnership and LLC taxation advanced issues on September 30th. So if you're going to be around in those locations and you're going to be available to take courses that day, I will gladly hope to see you on those courses. And, you know, hopefully you'll be able to come out and see us at those courses. If you can, go ahead and check your state society, sign up, and we'll see you on those days. Now let's talk about some of the cases that came up this week. And let's start with the first one here. This is actually not a case, but the IRS's response to a TIGTA document. The TIGTA report, the Treasury Inspector General for Tax Administration, issued a report that is entitled Processes Are Not Sufficient to Assist Victims of Employment-Related Identity Theft. That is TIGTA reference number 2016-40-065. It was officially issued on August the 10th, but actually published last week on their website. This actually goes back to a follow-up from TIGTA of a report they issued back in 2011. TIGTA noticed that the IRS, despite in 2011 telling the Treasury Inspector General's office that they were going to start notifying taxpayers, start a program to notify taxpayers if their Social Security number had been used on W-2s that were submitted with other tax returns, the IRS hadn't actually done much with that. And so we still didn't have those notices as of today. What the IRS has now announced and what TIGTA came back and said, hey, guys, you know, basically, why haven't you been doing this? The IRS has stated now that they do plan to start notifying everybody in January of 2017. They'll start notifying taxpayers. What had happened up to now, and part of the reason why I suspect none of this went forward, was if the IRS, obviously, if the IRS didn't catch employment-related identity theft, and in fact, the individual in question, they filed the return, the CP2000 comes out because your client didn't actually report this income on their return. Well, that you basically got notified you had employment-related ID theft eventually, because obviously at some point you realized there was a W-2 that you really had never seen and had never worked for the company, and there was a problem there. But if the IRS caught it, flagged it, but hadn't, and you know, flagged your account, there was no CP2000, and there was a note on the file for potential identity theft, they simply hadn't been notifying taxpayers. Now, following up on this TIG to follow up to the 2011 report, the IRS will start issuing such notices. The big issue there for those of us here in practice is going to be that clients will start getting these notices. That's going to probably be our bigger problem that we're going to have long term. We're going to have to explain to clients who get them what the impact is of this. Now, it's never good. The good news is if you got this notice, the IRS was aware it's a problem, and so you probably don't have IRS problems with the W-2. And the IRS is likely also aware to keep an eye out for fraudulent tax returns or ID theft where people file fake returns. So, okay, the IRS may be up to speed. The bad news is most likely the person that used your ID to get employment, they weren't really the person that stole your ID. They didn't get your number. You know, they didn't go hack into your accounts to get numbers. Rather, they almost certainly bought this number from a vendor. And what this really means is that the taxpayer is aware that their data is available most likely on these databases for sale. That suggests they could have other problems in the future. And so the real issue for clients like that is they probably should start considering, A, checking very carefully their credit reports, consider even a credit freeze on the accounts in that case. Also, they should be aware to, you know, keep a close eye on bank accounts and other items. Again, their data is in play. There also could be potential problems with medical data. The hitch is really that this is a notification, which is important to understand that your data is in the wild. And even if, you know, if it's just used for this, it's probably not a serious problem. But the bad side is that it could very well be used for more than this, and that's where we're going to run into trouble. So as we say, be sure you be ready, and be ready for clients to get these notices next year. My guess is they weren't issuing notices before because the IRS didn't want the phone calls on this. And honestly, we're going to get the phone calls too. So be aware of that issue as we move forward. Next up, we're going to talk about the case of Mamere versus Commissioner, Tax Court Summary Opinion 2016-047. This case was issued on August the 25th. And in this particular case, a taxpayer attempted to get American Opportunity Tax Credit for educational expenses that he had incurred. Well, that's all well and good, except that it turns out the taxpayer didn't pay expenses that were eligible. The taxpayer in question was enrolled in a, you know, education program, which, you know, a qualified program, secondary education. As part of this program, he needed to use a computer to research items. And the campus had computers available, a few of them available in the lab. Now, he had to work days. You know, he was doing this as an evening course. He had very limited hours he could go to the on-campus location. Also, he finished up the course while he had to travel overseas. And therefore, obviously, he wouldn't have access to the campus computers. So he went to a local computer store, bought a computer, and he picked that up as a payment for an expense required for his course and took an American Opportunity Tax Credit on this. Well, there are a couple of problems. The major problem here is, first rule is, to qualify for this generally, it needs to be an expense that was paid to the school and it needs to be something that was required as part of the program. In this case, he lost on both. First, he didn't acquire it from the school. He acquired it from a local computer store. Wonderful, but not going to give him the credit. Second problem he had was that although the computer was helpful, it wasn't required. And for the credit, it needs to be required as part of your course of study. You can take it if, in fact, you had to buy the computer from the institution to basically get your education. But if it's not required, which it was in this case, wasn't acquired from the institution, that's two strikes. You're pretty much done. You don't have, you know, you've lost out on two different reasons why we no longer, why we're not going to be allowed to take that credit. Next up, well, Congress, of course, changes laws on us, and they do so retroactively. And so yet again, the IRS had to issue a revenue procedure. This is 2016-48. This is a new procedure issued on August the 26th of 2016. It gives us guidance for retroactive depreciation changes in the PATH Act. As you may remember, last year we had, for most of 2015, assets placed in service. We no longer had bonus depreciation available on them. And as well, if you use the special real estate 179 provisions in the prior years, you had to treat those assets as, you know, any excess unused depreciation had to be taken as an asset placed in service on the first day, you know, the first day of the first tax year beginning in 2014. So we had to go ahead and start depreciating those assets on the 14 returns. Congress retroactively extended those rules. Now we got problems because we filed returns claiming it the other way. What the IRS has effectively done is allowed us to either accept the returns as filed. Now remember, generally for bonus depreciation, you have to elect out a bonus. So what we're going to do is, if you want to just keep, it's not worth changing the old return, the IRS will allow you to treat that as if you had made an election out of bonus depreciation on that return you previously filed. You don't have to. You can go ahead and file an amended return and claim the depreciation, or your third option, as it's been before, in one of the first 2 years following, you can file a 3115 change of depreciation, change of accounting method, and do a catch-up 41A adjustment in that year. For the Section 179, the same basic rules apply, except there's no 3115 option. You can either go back and treat that as, you know, no claim of depreciation on the return for the first year beginning in 2014. Rather, you can go ahead and treat that as a carryover into the 15 year and then fix the 15 return, both of those by amended returns, or you can go ahead and just simply accept the amount that was placed in service. Similarly, they give you options there. If you're one of those organizations that wanted to make the election to bypass bonus depreciation and get the larger limits for the general business credit or for AMT credit carryovers, those options are found in this same revenue procedure. Again, that revenue procedure in question is revenue procedure 2016-48. Next up, we have an issue here where the Ninth Circuit takes a look at an appeal from the tax court. You may remember this case, Shea Holmes versus Commissioner. It came out in 2014. And that was 142 TC number 3. Shea Holmes dealt with the completed contract method of accounting for a home builder. And in the Shea Holmes case, the IRS had argued that a taxpayer, in computing the 95% limitation, everybody should remember, a completed contract, one of the ways you have your contract completed, if the buyer has taken possession of the property and 95% of the costs have been incurred. Well, Shea Holmes was stating that the 95% rule had not been triggered because they were including costs of the general improvements of the entire development in the 95% calculation, while the IRS claimed in the tax court that none of those costs should count and only the exact costs on the lot, you know, for each lot should be treated. So whenever they sold a home, if they completed the work on that was required for that lot, that should trigger the 95% test. The tax court ruled that those development-wide expenses should be considered as part of the 95% test. The IRS appealed this decision. And on appeal, the IRS decided maybe they had argued this a little bit wrong. The IRS at trial had made it all dependent on whether or not any of those costs for the common area should be included in 95% calculation. Shea Holmes had actually done 95% of the entire development for completed contract purposes. The IRS hadn't objected to that as the measuring level because they objected to any use of the common area. Now the tax court, now the Ninth Circuit, when they went to the Ninth Circuit, the IRS said, oh, wait a minute. Little problem here. If you do accept those, we now agree you can accept the common area costs, but it should only be that particular buyer's share, so proportionate share of the cost, not we have to get the entire project to 95% the way Shea had computed. The Ninth Circuit panel rejected and accepted the tax court case. All three of the judges pointed out that the IRS simply had not argued this at the trial court. And the issue being here, well, you know, IRS, tough luck. You didn't raise that at trial. And you're not supposed to be able to pull this off later. You had placed all your eggs in the basket of the 95% of none of the common area cost counting. This is very similar. You may remember in the case of Davis versus Commissioner, the Ninth Circuit had similarly ruled that Al Davis had placed all of his eggs in one basket. Instead of challenging the IRS's assessment, he had placed it all in whether the IRS had violated the agreement that they had, the closing agreement, made the entire assessment invalid. Same problem here. All three judges agree the IRS had, you know, placed its bets on the wrong horse, shall we say. However, two of the three judges went ahead and decided that the tax court had decided right anyway, that Shea Holmes was correct to base a 95% on the entire project. One of the judges refused to go there. He said they should have simply said that the IRS didn't argue this, and he's not sure that it's absolutely clear that we really should be using the 95% of the entire project should be the test. So in that case, we have a slightly different problem. That judge believes, and pretty clear from the way he wrote it, if he had to decide that case, he would almost certainly have decided that you just don't count any of that. And, you know, basically, or it has to be counted on a per house. So you break that down by house. This could be interesting because as this case goes outside the Ninth Circuit, as you start trying to apply this in other parts of the country, it'll be interesting to see if, in fact, the other circuits will accept that, or if the IRS in the tax court now tries to argue that, okay, we accept that common area costs have to count. We do not accept that you treat the whole project as one. So keep your eyes on developments here. Certainly, I think in the Ninth Circuit, it's pretty clear that we're okay with full development for now, at least unless Shea Holmes appeals, not unless the IRS appeals this. But outside the Ninth Circuit, you might see some traction on basically the dissenting opinion here, and perhaps an idea that it really should be treated differently. Next up, in Program Manager Technical Advice 2016-10 issued on August the 31st, we raised a question about whether the Bobrow case should apply to Coverdell ESA rollovers. Now, if you remember the Bobrow case from a couple of years ago, that was the case where, despite what the IRS publication said, we effectively, you know, were told in the court that if you have two IRA accounts, let's say one with Schwab and one with Merrill Lynch, the IRS publication suggests that I could take money out of my Schwab account. I could then hold it for 60 days, put it back in the Schwab account. Now we have the one rollover per year rule. However, the publication indicated clearly that I could still anytime go to the Merrill Lynch account, take money out of there and roll that back in the Merrill Lynch account, that the 1 year was on a per account basis. In the Bobrow case, the tax court ruled and the IRS has agreed and now revised the regs in publication that no, once you take that first dollar out, that first distribution from the Schwab account, my example, that's going to basically taint you for a full year. So you can't go to the Merrill Lynch account within that year period and take money out of that account for a secondary rollover. Now the question came down, well, do the same rules apply to Coverdell ESAs? Coverdell ESAs, the language that governs Coverdell ESA rollovers, and they're allowed rollovers just like IRAs, just like traditional IRAs, the language that governs those is very similar to the language that governs the rollovers for IRAs in Section 408. The National Office ruled in this case that, in fact, we're going to get the same result. So if you have Coverdell IRAs, Coverdell ESAs, always want to use the old term because they were adopted as education IRAs, but Coverdell ESA, you have a Coverdell ESA with, let's say we established one with Schwab and we have one with Merrill Lynch. If we take a rollover from the Coverdell ESA with Schwab and put that into, you know, return that within 60 days, that's going to block us from going to the Merrill Lynch account in the interim. The same rule that applied in the Bobrow case, traditional IRAs, will apply to Coverdell ESAs in this case. Finally, the IRS made final the regulations found in Treasury Decision 9785. This revises Regulation 301.7701-18, effectively adopting the proposed regulations the IRS put out a year ago. These regs were issued on September the 2nd, 2016. These regulations deal with the definition of marriage following the Obergefell and Windsor Supreme Court decisions in this area. Remember, those decisions, the Windsor decision said the federal government had to respect a marriage between same-sex couples, that the DOMA law was simply unconstitutional, that said the feds wouldn't recognize that. And Obergefell then went on and went one step further and said states could not prevent marriages between individuals of the same sex. These regulations attempt to deal with that. One of the problems we have in the code is that the code and the regs make several references to husband and wife, which have a gender, inference of gender. When you see husband, inference of male, wife, inference of female. Now, the problem is, since that's technically illegal per the Supreme Court, does the IRS need to go back and revise every reg to change the word husband and wife to spouses? And should Congress be revising the law? And what the IRS decided to do in this reg was, no, we're not going to go try to find every place this is used, because that's going to be a search and replace forever, and there'll be tons of revised regs. Rather, this regulation effectively states that husband and wife will be treated as gender neutral whenever they are found in the code or regs. That's part of what the original proposed regs said. What was a little more interesting and got discussion here, and you'll see this in the, if you take a look at the preamble to these regs, there was a lot of discussion about whether the IRS was correct in not treating civil unions or registered domestic partner status as married. A number of states have statuses that are called civil unions or registered domestic partners. The IRS had ruled originally that since those statuses were different, those states now have both that status, which may give rights just like marriage, and married status. And if the states have kept the other status, which most of them have, the question becomes, well, you know, should they just treat that as married if the rights are the same? The IRS ruled no. The states kept two statuses. Presumably an individual who has individuals that maintain the other status and did not go to become married have some reason for doing so. And the IRS is only going to recognize marriage as a status. They're not going to recognize these others as being equivalent to marriage. What that does mean is somebody who, let's say a couple that is registered domestic partners or in a civil union, they will be able to continue to file as single or head of household. And even more interesting, if they're in a community property state that has those particular treatments, and the community property state grants community property rights to people who are, let's say, registered domestic partners, that's actually going to result normally in a major tax advantage over being married, even though you have all the same rights. Now, as the commentators said, what gets a little more complicated if you don't treat that as marriage is what happens when they decide to split the union. They'll go through a process similar to divorce, but we'll have no special tax rules that tell us how to treat that. The IRS says, well, life's complicated. If you want to solve that problem, get married. If you don't, you know, if that's not your issue, we assume that there's a valid reason we're keeping these other status around. And so for that reason, the IRS is not going to treat this as marriage. They also rejected a second comment that suggested, well, if you want to do that, why don't you make sure community property is only restricted to married status? The IRS rejected that too. Technically in this reg, simply said that's beyond the scope of this reg, and that is a lot more complicated. I have a serious question whether the service could even do that, because property rights are generally the rights of state law. And in order to have an ignore community property rule, generally Congress has passed those rules where we ignore community property rights. So I have a serious question whether the service could even do what that commentator suggested. In any event, we now have the final definition of marriage. And the good news is it's basically the definition that we've been working on since those two cases came down. Well, it's that time of year to start filling out your fall CPE work. And, you know, trick or treats are coming. Now Halloween's on the way. In fact, I was just down at a convenience store and see they have Reese's in the shape of pumpkins. So if you like Reese's peanut butter cups, those are already sitting out at the counter for checkout. You want to make sure you check your state CPE society, your state society of CPAs, because there's various CPE treats available in their catalog. Be sure you look there, sign up, and be ready to start taking the courses. We have a whole bunch coming up. I'm going to be doing a lot of work. I'm going to be on the road here at the end of September, then take a little time off because, of course, we have till October 15th, the filing deadline. Following October 15th is when things get really serious, and that's kind of our year-end push. You want to make sure if you're going to be taking course that time, go ahead and sign up for those courses now. It's useful. You make assured they're there. You know you have your position in it, and you can take a look at that catalog now and be ready to go. This has been the current federal tax developments for the week of September the 6th. Welcome to the end of summer. You can catch our updates regularly at the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website at www.currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also, from that site, download a PDF that'll have articles on all today's topics on the weekly updates page. Also, be sure if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there is @edzollers. Looking forward to seeing you all in the future, seeing you next week. And we'll talk to you about new developments. I am going to be a little more interested in my travel next week, and I've got a kind of disrupted weekend to go with it. So hopefully everything will go and everything will go up on time. But don't be surprised if we're a little bit late getting next week's podcast out. So we'll hope for the best. But in any event, whenever it comes out, I look forward to seeing you here on Current Federal Tax Developments.